International.
Ici Radio-Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. On past programs, we've taken a look at the media in places such as China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, India, Pakistan, the United States, in Europe, Russia, and many, many other places. Today, however, we're focusing on the media of one particular region in the world with a two-part program. And it's an area of the world that, well, has a lot of news coverage, but we really haven't touched on before, and that is the Middle East. Today we bring you part one of a two-part documentary produced and presented by John Lloyd called The Media and the Middle East.
Last month, on his return from the war in Gaza, the veteran presenter of the British independent Channel 4 News, John Snow, made a remarkable statement.
I'm back. And in the comfort of this studio, it's hard to imagine I was ever away.
He gave notice that objectivity and balance, the golden rule of British broadcasting and the most precious and embattled commodity in contemporary journalism, was not his aim. Bearing witness was.
What I never knew is what I know now, which is that those people who live in Gaza are mainly, but unbelievably young. The average age is 17. That means that about 250,000 are under 10. And you know, if you know any 10-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 4-year-olds, the idea in the looseness of a war zone, that you can control your children, that they won't be somewhere where they can be hit, is, you know, beyond any kind of imagination. You can't hope to control that. So that in a very densely packed urban area, if you decide to throw missiles, shells and the rest, then undoubtedly you will kill children. And that is what they do.
They are, of course, the Israeli army. As he knew would happen, Snow invited and got a torrent of both praise and abuse. He had, after all, implicitly proposed that British broadcast journalism should reflect its reporters' beliefs. Journalism on the long conflict between Israelis and Palestinians produces responses of high emotion, composed of fear, of anger, of accusations of racism and of anti-Semitism, the flinging about of words like Holocaust, Nazis, fascist, Islamo-fascist, with hideous abandon. It was the most contested coverage in the world, even before the web and social media multiplied interactivity and thus challenge and counter-challenge, insult and counter-insult, 100, even 1,000-fold. How this hottest of spots has been broadcast to British viewers and listeners over the past decades is the subject of this programme.
Jerusalem has long been the focal point of the still unsolved problem of Palestine. Although in times of comparative peace, Jews and Arabs live side by side and go about their business in the old city of Jerusalem with apparent calm, beneath the surface, bitter enmity has continued to smoulder for years.
That was Movietone News, a staple in cinemas right up to the 70s, a Hollywood musical-like take on the news which treated the stories it did like little feature films. Its coverage of Palestine in the years before Israel became a state, described as criminals, the armed Jewish guerrilla groups dedicated to ridding the country of British soldiers. Groups like the Stern Gang and the Irgun used the terror tactics of bombs and assassinations against the army deployed to keep the peace in Palestine, for which the British then had the mandate.
The King David Hotel itself. It was in the wing on the right of the picture that the terrorists placed their explosive. And the result of the crime, the tragic scene, is like a serious incident during the Blitz. The hotel housed the British Army headquarters and the Palestine government offices, and casualties were very heavy. 65 deaths are reported, and there is little or no hope of survival for any of the 58 missing. Nearly 50 others were injured. The Jewish terrorist organization, Irgun Zvi Leumi, openly admitted responsibility for the bombing. Many arrests have been made. Leaders of the Jewish agency have expressed horror at the dastardly crime perpetrated by a gang of desperados.
But the media mood soon changed. When Israeli statehood was declared in 1948, the event was seen by the Western media as a triumph. The young men seen as pioneers, the terror gangs swiftly forgotten. The pictures in the clip you're about to hear show, in grainy black and white, young Jewish men leaving Marseille for Palestine, quitting a Europe which had subjected them to violence, to pogroms and the Holocaust, to create a space they could defend, call their own.
There is no longer any pretense at family immigration into Palestine. There are no old people aboard. Women are left behind. And the tough young men packing the rails to catch their last glimpse of peaceful France are soldiers.
They didn't come to an empty land. In Palestine, at the beginning of the tragic 20th century, there were 500,000 Arabs, Bedouin and Druze, greatly outnumbering the Jews. How then did the BBC see this other people back in 1949?
With the refugee problem of Hitler's Europe still an unhappy and recent memory, another of the same kind has been building up in Palestine, where nearly a million harmless Arab villagers have been made homeless as a result of war in the Holy Land. In various parts of Palestine and Transjordan, flimsy and insanitary settlements, made only out of scraps of wood, ragged canvas and pieces of tin, are now the only homes of the dispossessed.
Israel appears on screen in the late 1940s and 1950s as a new, thrusting, ambitious land with European values and systems brought by the settlers. The Arabs, conquered and driven out, are at least the potential enemy. David Cesarani, who's the research professor of Jewish history at Royal Holloway University in London, says that the reporting takes its tone and content from the prevailing geopolitics of the Middle East.
British coverage of the Middle East, the coverage of Israel during the mid-1950s, was overdetermined by the fear, the threat of Arab nationalism. That culminated in the collusion between Britain and France and Israel in 1956. And the fact that Britain got a bloody nose in the Suez affair in some ways reinforced the admiration for Israel. Israel became a strategic partner in the region for Britain and France. So it's no surprise that during that period, there was very little attention paid to Palestinian Arabs.
Daoud Kutab, a Palestinian journalist and a professor of journalism, sees the same blindness to Palestinian issues and to the Palestinians themselves as Cesarani does.
There was some mention of the Palestinians, often mentioned as Arabs, who kind of like local natives. It was a very kind of a colonial, paternalistic coverage of, you know, some of the locals who were not happy and so on. But it was not any attempt to try to show equality or that there is a indigenous Palestinian national movement that was desiring to have its own state.
The prospect of a Palestinian state was in the 1950s discussed, but was given no solid basis. The State of Israel was a fact on the ground, and Palestinian hostility to it, most marked on its borders, was an ingrained feature of life. On these borders, the armed watchfulness of the Israeli farmer soldiers was treated by the BBC in 1954 with admiring sympathy, and without explanation of the reasons for their weapons.
With tension continuing along the frontiers of Israel, these latest pictures show how the farmers are constantly prepared for border incidents. Guns are carried by the young Israelis, all of them are under 20, in this new collective settlement of Nahal Oz as they go about their daily work. The settlement is close to Egyptian territory near Gaza. On the perimeter of the farm, watchtowers are manned by armed guards who keep a continual lookout. Revolvers are worn by those actually at work in the fields. In this settlement, the corn is cut before it is fully ripe, in case it should be stolen or destroyed by marauders.
If the commentaries are one-sided, they're not wrong. The Israelis did bring a revolution to the land in scientifically planned agriculture, which made it the world's leading producer of citrus fruits, and technologies unseen on the land before in raising a standard of living, not just for the Jews, but for the Arabs who remained as well. The coverage often reached into the Bible for phrases to adequately describe this transformation. Here's Pathé News in 1956.
Haifa, the gateway to Israel, is a busy modern port with a two-way traffic in citrus fruits and dreams. The fruit goes out harvested by a young, vigorous nation. The dreams come in, brought in by the immigrants who arrive in increasing boatloads every week. For young and old, the dream is the same. A country of their own that most of them call the Promised Land.
The Promised Land, a land, the Old Testament tells us, promised to Moses by God. A claim to the land, sanctified by scripture, modernized by the new Israelis.
Making the dream come true is a tough job. Reclaiming neglected land, making the orange groves flourish in place of the dry scrub. Conquering the desert with science and enthusiasm. It is a job so well worth doing that men of science have come from all parts of the world to centers like the Weizmann Institute to experiment and study.
The film and broadcast coverage gave a steadily upbeat account of brave endeavour bolstered by modern science and technology transforming a barren land, never, it seemed from the commentary, cultivated before. For broadcasters especially, less so for newspapers and magazines where context was fuller, nuance more possible, Palestinians were a threat or victims of an unexplained tragedy. Daoud Kutab once more.
Yes, you saw Palestinian victims, Palestinians becoming refugees, but they never spoke, they never had a voice. And so you have Palestinians who are basically voiceless, faceless, you know, living in tents and so on. So there is reference to Palestinian refugee status, but you don't feel that there is a nation or a nationhood or a national movement that is desiring their own state, their own country, their own voice.
The climax of this style of reporting, close to propaganda, was during and after the Six-Day War in 1967, where in a series of manoeuvres, still seen as exemplary, Israel's forces overwhelmed the armies of Egypt, Jordan, Iraq and Syria in under a week. It was a feat of arms which drew forth a journalism which, whatever its protestations, didn't try to be objective. And in the cinema newsreel form, the music and commentary swells like a clip from the 1960 Hollywood film Exodus.
And Israel shall be a proverb among all peoples. Across the deserts of Sinai, a biblical prophecy comes to pass as the forces of Israel sweep on in an astonishing triumph of strategy. Inspired by Defense Minister Dayan, she took just over 50 hours to achieve her two main objectives. To reach the Gulf of Aqaba and lift the blockade and leave the Egyptians shoeless in Gaza. However impartial one tries to be, one can only admire the efficiency of this extraordinary advance westwards, as well as the sword thrust to the east into Jordan.
The 1973 war wasn't like that. A surprise Arab attack led by Egypt on one side and Syria on the other had the Israelis reeling for a few days before they regrouped, pushed back the Syrians, then the Egyptians, and turned counterattack into a rout. BBC's Martin Bell was on the Sinai Peninsula when the Egyptian Third Army surrendered.
The fighting continued throughout the afternoon, and it was still going on when I asked the commander of the Israeli forces here, General Abraham Edan, which side had broken the ceasefire.
Well, the Egyptian broke it yesterday, at night and also in the morning, and we answered it. At the beginning it was on a local base, and then it exploded. So we fought back and we improved out a little bit our tactical situation.
According to your information, what has happened now to their Third Army?
Well, I think that the Third Army is cut out, he is surrounded. We know that the Tel Army don't have enough ammunition, enough food. I think that his days are very little.
Is it still a fighting force?
Well, it still fights, but not an army anymore.
One-sided coverage wasn't wholly the Western media company's fault. They could embed with the Israelis, they couldn't with the Arab armies. David Cesarani sees the post-war coverage taking a new direction.
Well, I think that from 1948 until the Yom Kippur War in 1973, the template was small, plucky Israel, David versus the Arab Goliath. And I don't think that the media really appreciated the extent to which, after 1967, Israel was a regional superpower.
David Cesarani marks an important breakpoint. Plucky little Israel encountered a shift in perception, from little to large, from plucky to oppressive. Meanwhile, the Palestinians, especially a new generation, began to fashion their narrative for the Western media, as well as for themselves.
Palestinians found their voice. The PLO, led by Yasser Arafat, by a combination of terrorism that grabbed the headlines, and by savvy media efforts, began to get its message across. So you have a Palestinian national movement that is better organized, more vocal, more effective, and a much more receptive audience for it amongst generations of young people who had grown up seeing Israel as a regional superpower, as a colonial power.
Anton LaGuardia, Middle East and Africa editor of The Economist, thinks that a consequence of the Six-Day War was that the Palestinians decided they had to fight their own battles in their own name, not wait for the Arab armies to liberate them.
And you get the development of radical Palestinian groups who start to hijack planes and hijack people. For example, the hostage-taking of Israeli athletes at Munich.
Well, the last deadline set by the terrorists expired 2 hours ago, but apparently negotiations between them and representatives of the federal, state and city authorities have continued.
A hostage-taking and a bungled rescue operation in September 1972 resulted in disaster. 11 Israeli Olympic athletes, as well as others, were killed. The Israel-Palestine conflict had spilled over into Europe, and the language of the time is clear. Western reporters were in no doubt that Palestinians were terrorists. Anton LaGuardia again.
So Palestinians, yes, burst into the consciousness of Westerners as Palestinians, but as a problem, as an uncomfortable problem that many people disliked and disrupted their lives because air travel suddenly became very unsafe.
A harsher situation emerged. Politics within Israel became more polarised, tougher. The main party of the right, Likud, broke the Labour hegemony in the 70s. It allowed or encouraged ever larger settlements on the West Bank, settlements which became and remained a major element in critical media coverage. Daoud Kutab.
The settlements and the settlement movement and reaction to it and opposition to it started to change the narrative. It was no longer the narrative of the Israelis waiting for, you know, Palestinians to make peace, but it was the Israelis digging in deeper and the occupation becoming more permanent.
On the 30th anniversary of the State of Israel in 1978, there's congratulation, but something of a new commitment to give the Palestinians a voice, to see and hear an individual speak. The BBC reporter here has visited an Israeli settlement. Then he goes to the nearby Arab village where he interviews a young woman activist whom he names. She isn't merely a victim, but a person in her own right.
After one recent clash, the Palestinian writer Raimonda Tawil was imprisoned for alleged incitement. She summed up Arab reaction to the arrival of the settlers.
Well, it is the most difficult thing. We feel that our existence is being threatened every day, and that's why we should fight. We should fight to regain our identity, our nationhood. And this is the most difficult thing, is the Israeli presence, the occupation, the settlements. They are taking from us everything, the lands. They are uprooting us from the lands by taking our lands and building settlements. It means by time our presence will not exist anymore here in this area.
Is there any way in which you could accept the Israeli government's proposals that there should be Arab self-rule on the West Bank, but with a military presence by the Israelis?
No, by any means. It can't be. It's impossible. It's occupation.
Israel's actions were no longer given a free pass, as those of a threatened state reacting in self-defence. In 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon in retaliation for an attempted assassination of the country's ambassador in London by a dissident Palestinian group. In the Sabra area of West Beirut and the adjacent Shatila refugee camp, Israeli units stood by as Lebanese Christian militia slaughtered several thousand Palestinians and Lebanese Shia. And this, too, was a major break. Lisa Goldman, co-founder of 972 magazine, a liberal online forum on matters Israeli, describes 1982 as a tipping point.
Israel's invasion of Lebanon, and particularly its bombardment of West Beirut, that was, I think, the beginning of a more critical coverage of Israel, certainly in the European and English language media.
The coverage, simply by being factual, was damning. And in time, the event and the protests internationally and within Israel forced the resignation of Ariel Sharon, then the defence minister. This is the then BBC's Middle East correspondent, Tim Llewellyn, on Sabra and Shatila, being interviewed by Gordon Clough for The World this weekend.
I suppose the big and awful question is whether the Israelis were acting in any sort of way in connivance with whoever did all this.
It's very difficult to know whether there was any connivance. All I can do is set out the facts as we know them, and that is that, according to many correspondents and to senior Western European diplomatic sources who are eyewitnesses, the killing in these camps went on from around midday on Friday, well into the night of Friday, and in some cases was continuing early on the Saturday morning. The shooting must have been heard. The entry of the Christian militiamen into the camp must have been seen. The Israelis were only hundreds of yards away. They did nothing for a period of 24 hours while the Christian phalangists did their work inside these camps. There is evidence to suggest that the Israelis were taken by surprise, that in the end they started to intervene. But there was a long period of time while they stood by and did nothing. And we know from the positions that the Israelis had, they stated clearly that they were around this camp. They were in control of all the main routes to the camp. And I know that Israeli tanks were less, in many cases, than 400 yards away from the places where these people were gunned down. So I think, you know, to use the words of one diplomat here, it was either criminal negligence, a sin of omission, or a sin of commission, and we just don't know.
Tim Llewellyn, no longer a BBC correspondent, is now an outspoken critic of his old employer, believing it to be influenced by what he terms the Jewish lobby, the corporation refusing to understand that Israel is an occupier and the Palestinians its victims. Like Lisa Goldman, historian David Cesarani sees 1982 as a watershed in media coverage and perceptions of Israel.
The invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and the siege of Beirut that went on and on and on was also covered intensively by the media and was on television every night. Israeli jets bombing Palestinian refugee camps. The protracted nature of that coverage, the powerful images, the apparent one-sidedness of the conflict was, I think, a turning point in media coverage because it created a new template. We went from Israel, the plucky little state, David versus Goliath, to the bullying regional superpower crushing relentlessly the Palestinian people, dispossessed refugees, turning all the might of a modern military force on people who could barely fight back. And I think that for a generation of people who watched those images, Israel was never the same again.
And next week on the program, we will bring you part two of our two-part documentary, The Media and the Middle East, produced and presented by John Lloyd from the BBC World Service. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program and how you heard it, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. Once again, mnp@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.